Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference Podcast. This podcast features a conference keynote session presented by Neil Gershenfeld, Director of the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT. His session is titled, Distance versus Distributed Education, Bringing the Campuses to the Student.
So EDUCAUSE talks about intelligent use of information technology. Information technology, you do software, services, computer science, stuff like that. You don't do hardware, manufacturing, physical science. Other people do that. But nature doesn't work that way. Nature doesn't separate hardware and software. Everything happens everywhere at the same time. And there are a number of cracks in the matrix where external reality is coming into the reality of computers. Buildings waste a third of our energy because they haven't learned the lessons of the internet. The infrastructure of the building can't think. Data centers are approaching the power consumption of a city and increasingly the cost of a city. So you can choose between a city or a data center. Full custom chips at the 32 nanometer node are passing $100 million. It's crazy. And I blame two people. I blame him. He taught us that thinking, computing, is separate from the tape, the information. And again, in physics, that's not how it works. And I blame him. He enshrined what Turing did in an architecture where there's a processing organ separate from a memory organ, separate from a communication organ. Now, it's important to go back. The way we compute today was developed for this. It's not a law of nature. The seminal report that gave us the architecture we use today was sort of a hack to make this machine work. The technology has come a long way from that picture, but you all still compute essentially based on a hack to make that machine work. I'm part of a group of people who's been working on a project saying, we got it wrong. We just have to do computer science all over again. Computer science pretends physical reality doesn't exist. You live in a world of software, and then somebody else makes it happen. Instead, we're saying, what if you started all over and computed with reality, embraced rather than avoid it? So I won't do details now, ask me more later, but this is a model of computation that has the same units as physics. So the distance you travel is the time it takes to travel, is the amount of information you can store, is the number of operations you can do. They're all coupled as they are in the physics, not in the pretend software world. And so here's, for example, a program multiplying matrices. It's a nice way to do it because you can do it in a linear time, so you don't need fast transforms. But more than that, what you're looking at isn't a simulation. This is the program. The program is a physical model that has dynamics that compute, and it's supported by all kinds of ways to program it. So it's like Google Maps. When you fly in from Earth to this building, you change representation from the state to the city to the town, but it's the same underlying data structure. In the same way here, as you fly in and out, it's still physical reality zooming in and out through these levels of description. So that's an example of a asynchronous logic automata program. This isn't new. This is really just the endpoint of everything you know. It's RISC with one instruction as a logical gate. It's multi-core where every single bit becomes a processor. If you take all the things you do today and sort of reach the endpoint, they meet at this point at infinity. But what's nice is we've made versions for multi-core computers, sea of commodity processors, ASICs, molecular logic. You don't have to schedule execution. It's scalable to size. Power is only used where something's happened. The nature runs at the same speed no matter how much of it you use. Because this is built as physics, it maintains that property. And so where this leads us to is today, if you buy a computer, you pick what processor family, how much cache, what interconnect, how many blades you put in a rack, what switch for your rack. In this world of asynchronous logic automata, it all goes away. Computing is a raw material. It's just this sea of cells. They all run the same program. It's portable across all these. And you essentially buy the computer the same way you buy this stuff. You decide how many pounds or how many square feet of computing you use and really just apply it as a raw material. As physics is scalable, in this way computing is scalable. And so it's very promising for reducing power consumption, for increasing scaling in size, for getting across a number of the bottlenecks of the reality coming into computing. So it's promising for future computing, but even more interesting is if a program now isn't lines of code but a spatial structure, then you can program spatial structures equally as numbers. So this is a program running in a string that makes shapes. And in this, essentially, we did the opposite of the protein folding problem. Instead of figuring out what shape a protein makes, what we figured out is how do you make a protein to make a shape? And it turns out that's much easier. And the reason we're doing it is this is part of a project that's modestly trying to implement life in engineered materials. And we want to do that for manufacturing by putting codes in these materials. So these are a number of different versions. Just like I showed you, those cells work the same at any size. This version is proteins. This is nanoclusters, microfluidics, micromachines. This is an electromechanical system. It's essentially a mechanical protein. It does what protein folding does, but now in a mechanical system. What's interesting about that is a lesson that we can learn from the ribosome. The ribosome is the protein that makes the proteins in your body. It makes the muscles in my arm and the light sensors that let us see each other. And the real lesson is it's a computer. It runs a program. It reads a code. The code it reads in the messenger RNA does all the things a good modern code does. And then it builds with that code in the same way we learn to code. And that's what lets it make you with a spectacular complexity. And so what we're left with is we had a digital revolution in communications. That has a lot to do with, of course, the existence of EDUCAUSE. Telephones got worse with distance. Shannon wrote one of the best master's theses ever, where he showed you can error correct. He then went to Bell Labs. It's an interesting management lesson. At Bell Labs, they then spent 10 years fighting over whether the phone system should be analog or digital. And there's still enough people left who can explain the battle was won by attrition. The analog managers died. The digital managers took over. And we have the internet, and now you can watch this streaming through the whole EDUCAUSE community. So you get that lesson. This is the last great analog computer. Vannevar Bush made this at MIT. It's a room full of gears and pulleys. And the longer it ran, the worse the answer was. A larger group, von Neumann, Winograd, Cowan, digitized computing. And now we have the computers that power EDUCAUSE. You get that. But now manufacturing, the thing you don't think about. In the 50s at MIT, essentially an early air defense computer was connected to a machine tool for the first time to make a computer-controlled machine. That's not what I'm talking about. That's information in the tool. The materials are dumb. They just get smushed around. A state-of-the-art airplane, you now melt plastic instead of whacking at metal. There's really no change from this. If programs become spatial structures, then they can occupy things, and it means you can digitize fabrication just the way we digitize communication and computation. So computers don't just control tools, they become tools. Programs don't just describe things, they actually are things. And we really merge physical science and computer science, and you bring the programmability inside the computer to the world outside the computer. And making that step of programming reality in turn unpacks into lots of surprises. And that's what I really want to focus on. To do this research, thanks to all of your tax dollars, we bought this stuff. We wrote an ambitious NSF proposal that said to study digitizing reality, we needed tools to make anything on any length scale, and had an unusual moment, and NSF agreed. But we had a problem. It would take a lifetime to teach students to use all these machines. So I started a class modestly called How to Make Almost Anything. And it was for 10 research students who were going to learn to use the machines. And instead, the first day of the class looked like this room. We were just swamped. The next surprise is they weren't there for research. They were there to make stuff. Then the next surprise is what they did. In the semester, we taught embedded computing, 3D design, how to use the tools. Just very shameless hands-on. The students did semester projects where they integrated their skills. And this happened so consistently year in and year out, I realized the students were answering a question I hadn't asked, which is, what is digital fabrication good for? And the answer, of course, is personal fabrication. Ken Olson, head of digital, famously said, nobody needs a computer in the home. DEC is twice over bankrupt. You have computers in the home. He was saying you don't do inventory and payroll at home. In the same sense, the purpose of being able to make anything is not to buy what you can buy at Walmart. It's to buy what you can't buy at Walmart. It's personal expression in technology. You know, we make nests. We create our environment, but it's sort of been locked out, and it touches a passion unlike anything I've ever seen, this ability to kind of take control of our technical future. And it answers a question that I never understood growing up. When I was in high school, I really wanted to go to the vocational school. The vocational school was cool. You learned to weld and fix cars and build houses. And they said, no, you're smart. You have to sit in a room. It just didn't make sense. Nobody could explain to me why those were correlated. Once I could finally buy these machines, I came to appreciate it was a mistake made in the Renaissance. So literacy emerged as the trivium and the quadrivium, language, natural science. This was the birth of humanism. This wasn't politically liberal. This was liberation through mastery of these means of expression. And this was the moment when art and artisans separated. And there's this great notion of the illiberal arts. Making stuff was for commercial gain. It didn't count. These were the means of expression. And so we've been stuck with this notion of literacy based on the technology of the Renaissance, not just 1940 now, but a few centuries ago. And the students were showing 3D machining and microcontroller programming is every bit as expressive as painting a painting or writing a sonnet. It's new means of expression that just didn't exist when the canon of literacy emerged. So in turn, the class, How to Make Anything, is insane. We teach any one week is a whole semester's worth of stuff. And the way we can do that is with an intellectual pyramid scheme. There's a great window when you first learn to use a supersonic water jet cutter that you're just dying to tell somebody else. And so as long as students are flowing through, the ones who just learn document and teach the ones who are about to learn, and that process continues. So last week in this class, this semester, we taught how to make your own in-circuit programmer for microcontrollers. And so, for example, Andy made this beautiful page, much better than I could do, exquisitely describing how to make an in-circuit programmer. All the students use a collaborative site tool to build this. On the other hand, Sarah, her version of the very same content was to talk about how the way the boards are made reminded her of ice skating and cake decorating. And they're both ways to understand how to make an in-circuit programmer, two very different perspectives on doing that. So there's a good historical parallel. The way you make a car today is parts arrive just when you need them. And it's unlike the way you used to make cars, which you can think of as kind of just in case. You make everything you need in advance in case you need it. And just in case is how I was taught. I didn't learn to program a microcontroller until I understood quantum mechanics. You sort of stack up this warehouse of educational inventory to be used at some future date, whereas the How to Make Anything class was really peer-to-peer, project-based, just-in-time, demand-driven is what lets us cover so much. So in turn, given that viral spread at MIT, then NSF came back to us and said, that's fine, you spent so much money, show social impact. And we didn't really know what to do. We knew how to do the research. So we had adventurous NSF program managers, and we suggested, rather than talking about it, what if we gave people the tools? So we set up a little lab in inner city Boston, and then something very surprising happened.
In search of solutions for the world we share. Principal Voices, in association with Shell.
We've had a digital revolution, but we don't need to keep having it. We can declare success, we won. What's coming now is the digital revolution in fabrication. My colleagues and I started teaching a class called How to Make Almost Anything. And the idea was just that. It's a program looking at how the digital world relates to the physical world. And one of the core things coming out of the research is the idea of digital fabrication, making the Star Trek replicator, an assembler that makes anything you want by building the atoms on up. This is designed where you put in the ribbon. Millions of dollars of equipment at MIT are like the mainframes of digital fabrication. We can make anything we want using those tools. In 20 years, we'll make it so you can have it in the home. The fab labs are in between. They spread all around the world, letting ordinary people create technology from South Africa to the north of Norway and from rural India to inner city Boston. Instead of spending vast amounts of money to send computers and energy and communication around the world, you can spend much less to send the means to create it. Energy, communication, computation, just to say the words, they sound big. They're being tackled as billion-dollar mega projects top-down. Fab Labs is tackling them from the bottom up. We're just finding so many people with such interesting inventions and such great ideas. Sharing that is where I see this going.
Principal Voices, in association with Shell.
So that was an accident. The agenda we had, no agenda, we just set up one of these. We have these million-dollar machines. In 20 years, we will make the Star Trek replicator, with the insight that it's an exercise in embodying computation and putting programs into materials. And the Fab Labs emerged as a kind of market research. They were the best-used tools on campus, and it was about $50,000 in tools. But it's enough to make 2D structure, 3D structure, logic, sensing, actuation. And we made one in inner city Boston. Then there's a strong Ghanaian connection. So this went to Sekondi Takoradi in the coast of Ghana. Then there's a strong South African connection. This is Soshanguve, a shantytown outside Pretoria. It went to rural India, went to Jalalabad. They're doubling every year. And you just can't wake up in Cambridge, Mass. And say, Eastern Afghanistan needs precision fab tools. But every time we opened one, somebody else said, we need one. And they wanted it not for a digital divide on a computer screen. They wanted it for a divide in instrumentation and fabrication. They wanted to measure and modify the world around them. Again, there was no agenda. We set up one. But what emerged was a kind of a flow. It started with technical empowerment. These were young girls in inner city Boston who did rapid prototyping on a street corner and made hundreds of dollars. But more than that, there's just this joy of, this is cool, I can do this. Then the same kind of sort of pyramid scheme of peer-to-peer project-based education at MIT started happening in the field. In the clip I'll show you, we were setting up a lab in Ghana. There was a young girl. We had designed a little network sensor, and she insisted on staying late at night to make it just for the fun of it. So she did that by subtractive machining, precision machining, so there's no chemical waste. She did surface mount rework. She's about to load microcode. How many of you can do all of that? So it's not a joke in that she's not catching up. She's kind of skipping over the stage you went to do distributed advanced education, and she's not waiting to learn to program a microcontroller until she knows quantum mechanics. Then from there, the lab started doing useful things, and I'll show you some examples of those projects. And then a real surprise was research on campus started coming from the field, not backwards. An example close to home is I was teaching that my then 8-year-old daughter Grace how to use the tools in the lab. And she loved the computer-controlled laser, but she thought my project was really stupid. So she invented a 3D construction kit you can make from a cardboard box. And that was much more fun for her, make your own Lego in a scalable way. But I had a grad student who's working scaling 3D assembly of functional materials, and he was surprised. He was making complex 3D parts. Grace was making space-filling 3D volumes from friction-fit 2D parts, and he realized her design was much more scalable, so he did his thesis on the work of an 8-year-old girl. And that story keeps repeating. As much knowledge is now coming onto campus as is going off of campus from these. So, for example, in the lab in Afghanistan, one of the needs was connectivity, and it led to this project.
Now, a story about MIT students who helped build a wireless network in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, out of junk. They call it Fab Fi. That's a mix of Wi-Fi and Fab Lab. Students at MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms have created fabrication laboratories, or Fab Labs, across the globe. Fab Labs are like community centers with machinery and computers that the public can use to create things. The goal is for the community to use and develop technology that addresses their specific needs. And here to talk with us about the Fab Fi project in Afghanistan is MIT graduate student Amy Sun. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Robert.
So there was no comm infrastructure. Using the Fab Lab, they could make high-gain antennas, and then they could actually make their own internet terminals. And so they're doing now metropolitan area data infrastructure, not as a PTT coming in, but as a bottom-up community project. And in fact, this posting is them explaining how they came up with a much easier-to-make antenna that worked better than the design we taught them to make. And in turn, they're using this now to cache open courseware and Wikipedia and all sorts of information as resources in the community. And then there are all these wonderful moments of people saying, wow, I didn't know that. And kind of a reaction of, finally, here's aid we can do something with. Or there's a wonderful Fab Lab in Barcelona with artists, architects, and designers who felt like technologists weren't getting technology right. So they're picking up where Gaudi left off. If you look at Sagrada Familia, it's clear Gaudi didn't subcontract the civil engineering. He had wonderful ways he figured out how to do it. And so in the Fab Lab in Barcelona, they figured rather than using the tools to make a playhouse, why don't we use the rapid prototyping tools to make a full-size house? And so this was for the Solar Decathlon in Europe recently. So using the rapid prototyping tools, they cut out parts. You then snap together an instrument. And this was for the Solar Decathlon that recently ran in Madrid. And what was interesting is there were not 10 entries. 9 of them were rectangular boxes made conventionally. And there was this one gorgeous expressive one that was designed to maximize light capture and have shade underneath. And so all the other teams came and sat under this one. And then when it came time for the judging, they got exactly last place in the formal judging because it was weird. And they got first place in the people's judging because everybody said, this is what we'd like to live in. So now this is rapid prototyping way beyond where I expected it to go. It's actually making a solar house as, you know, as essentially a quick rapid prototyping project on a much larger scale. And then a natural next step is these are rapid prototyping machines made with the machines. This is a 3D printer, a 5-axis tool, a cutting tool. And so with that, the machines that cost thousands of dollars, you can now make ones for hundreds of dollars that in many ways exceed their specs. So when you come to the lab, you can not just learn the skills, but leave with the machine. So in retrospect, it gives us this roadmap. The fab labs that emerged as an accident, machines in labs, tools to make stuff. This next generation is now you can come to the lab and make all its machines, hundreds, not thousands of dollars. The step after that is digital assembly, codes and materials. So here's where we get rid of trash, and you can unbuild as well as build by disassembling the materials. And then the last stage is what I showed you at the beginning, is we actually put not just codes but programs in the materials so that there is no machine, and you have programmable matter, and you teach the programmable matter how to grow into what you want. So that's the research roadmap we're on. But now look at this parallel. Mainframes you understand. This is one of my favorite pictures. This is Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie inventing Unix on a PDP at Bell Labs. And if any of you date back to the PDP era, it wasn't a computer. There was a processor and rack, and there was a comm rack and cables, and you know, it wasn't easy to use, but it could be used by a work group, not a whole organization, and that's when email, internet, just about everything we do today happened at that point. Then came the hobbyist computers. So Altair was life-changing for me, and the killer app was you could flip the switches and the lights would blink. And then we got the PC and the rest. So if you line it up, the machines that make machines are like the Altair. The Star Trek replicator we're trying to make is like the PC or the iPhone. The original Whirlwind machining is like the mainframes. And the fab labs are pretty exactly the PDP era. And the lesson to take from that is what you do with computers didn't happen today, it happened then. Got faster, better, and cheaper, but you didn't need to wait for the iPhone to figure out email. And so the viral spread of the fab labs is the just below the radar process happening of if anybody can make anything anywhere, how do you live, work, and play in that world? This isn't a story about coming trends, it's a story about it's happening today. Every day we get messages, I want fab labs. Once a week somebody sends a note saying, I'm canceling my life, where do I report? And we just can't handle that. So we're spinning off from my lab at MIT, a nonprofit foundation, a for-profit fund, a degree program to support the scaling. For example, the lab that was in the video, this is hundreds of miles above the Arctic Circle, but it's got better connectivity, nicer lab space. Just about everything about it is better than my lab at MIT. And so in that world, building these organizations, and the one I want to focus in on is, of course, the educational one. These are some kids from the Fab Lab network. So Hans Peter was from this lab as far north as you can go in Norway. Satellite dishes there look at the ground, not the sky, because that's the way to them. He was considered a problem. He'd learned everything he could learn in school, and so he just, you know, they didn't know what to do with him. He didn't behave. And so he came to the Fab Lab. I showed him demonstration projects students do at MIT. He stayed up all night, did all of them. I saw him a few weeks later, and I didn't teach him anything else, and he made this robot truck. He put 4 motor controllers on a board, did a 3D design of the truck body, made the windshield, the display, designed this vehicle. And so what do we do with kids like that? The usual answer is, it's a variant of me in the vocational school. The answer is, you're smart, you have to leave. Where Hans lives is my favorite place on earth. It's just sort of biblically perfect, other than there aren't economic or educational opportunities. And so the usual answer is, you have to go away now. But more than that, the world in this room is full of STEM initiatives and innovation initiatives. And what so many of them get wrong is innovative people are strange. They don't behave well. They don't follow rules by definition. And so many of these programs create structured environments for people who just aren't structured. And so how do you take these inventive odd people distributed all around the world and give them an answer better than you have to leave now? And so we backed into creating the Fab Academy. Again, we didn't have a big educational vision. It was just we had to do something with the Chapisos and Hans Christians. So the idea of the Fab Academy was not distance learning, but it's distributed learning. We have a broadband video MCU that shares, for labs with connectivity, video streams. The students are in work groups in the labs with all the tools, and we teach classes using the whole Fab Lab network as a campus. And the initial focus is 1 year vocational training aimed at both employment and investment. There's movements both up and down, but that's where the greatest immediate demand is. And so we started teaching classes in that. One way you can kind of think about it is MIT's open courseware, dating back to Chuck Vest's push, recognized that the content of advanced education can now be shared widely. You can now think about the Fab Labs not as replacing but extending with, you can now not just bring content, but you can bring the campus. So rather than accessing remote material, if you can turn bits to atoms and atoms to bits, you can download a campus, not just a description. And so in all of the projects everybody's doing, nobody was really seriously providing the tools for invention. The labs provide the tools to turn data into things, which was initially for manufacturing, but can be used to make everything you do for research and education. There's an amusing historical parallel. Once upon a time, you had to go to places like the Vatican that had domes and courtyards and get access to specialized knowledge and wear funny hats. Then the press democratized access to printing. The rest is very much capital H history. Now you still go to places like MIT that have domes and courtyards, and you still wear funny hats to get access to specialized tools. And if you think about it, this is an essay I wrote on, is MIT obsolete? And the answer is not yet, but I went to MIT for the books. They're certainly online. I went to it for the people through things like the video network. I see colleagues in northern Norway more than most of my MIT colleagues because we're too busy to talk to each other. And I went for tools, but in that lab in northern Norway, it has most of the tools I went to MIT for. So the conclusion is there are still things where only a few people on the planet can do it, where you really need to bring them together. There are still projects that need heroically expensive tools that you can't distribute, that you need to go to. And so for those functions, you really do need these centralized seats of learning. But a lot of what I originally went to MIT for can now be done in a South African shantytown or an Arctic village. MIT is based on an assumption of scarcity. Because you assume tools, people, and knowledge is scarce, you say no to almost everything. You say no to applicants, and you say no to requests for space, you pay high overhead. That's worth doing for projects that really need all those capabilities, but it leads to you can do all of that for many things in a much more distributed way. So that's when I started talking to EDUCAUSE. We were backing into building an educational organization, and so we thought, great, we'll be a .edu. You know, called EDUCAUSE and said, how do we become a .edu? And they said, well, get accredited. So we said, fine, we'll get accredited. We called the accreditors, and they said, okay, that sounds like a great project, just what we like, where are you located? And I said, yes. You know, it was Earth. And so I said, excuse me, how do I accredit Earth? And they just shrugged. And they gave what was actually a good piece of advice. I don't know if any of them are here who I spoke to. They said, we get it. We'd like to do it. We just don't know how to accredit that. So make up a degree. And so that's what we did. We invented a degree, a Fab diploma taught by the Fab Academy. Its only accreditation is the integrity of what we're doing with it. And that's what we're teaching and giving. And they suggested, make up a degree and then let us catch up and figure out what to do with it. So this was the first year of graduation. And it's working. People get it. They're excited. People want to know if you had it. Do want to catch up with this notion that an educational institution increasingly is a network, not a place. And how do you recognize that? Not distance learning, but fundamentally distributed learning in networks like this. So this has a lot of historical parallels. None of this was obvious in advance. In retrospect, it's almost painfully obvious. Carnegie, at the turn of the last century, had a vision that literacy would empower. So right around the corner from my house is a building that looks exactly like this. It was a Carnegie library. He gave books to the masses and had a tremendous transformative impact on society. If you now look at Håkon, the herder in North Norway, or Kalbag, the farmer in India, or Mel, the community activists in Boston, one way you can view what they're doing is these are libraries. They're libraries for a new notion of literacy. Libraries give access to information. Once you merge physical science and computer science, it means bits can become atoms and atoms can become things. And so literacy doesn't stop at the page. It crosses this boundary between digital and physical. And so these are libraries for a new notion of literacy. Saying that points out you still have libraries even though you have books at home. Books at home don't obsolete the library. The library serves an anchoring function in the community for the sense of literacy. So one way to view what's emerging is libraries for a new sense of literacy. You'll have the Star Trek replicator at home, but you'll still have places like these fab labs as community resources for doing this. Or another way to think about it is this is Manchester, England, during the Industrial Revolution. They had 3/4 of the world's mills. They now have a football team. It's just been economically downhill since. So we're creating a fab lab with them, aiming at a second Industrial Revolution. Now, the key insight is the easy interpretation is this is to prototype products that you then ship off to China and mass produce. But the real power is if data can become things, it means you don't mass produce remotely and ship it. It means you send data and you do on-site, on-demand production. There's a very interesting parallel with the printers. Bought DEC that went bankrupt, then HP bought Compaq. HP could buy Compaq because of inkjet. Inkjet is as close as I've seen to corporate forgery. If you watch them actually making the inkjet cartridges, you know, it goes ka-chunk, 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 and then they charge $50 for them. And the background to it is in HP, the printer division, speed ruled. So whoever had the fastest printer was like most macho and most important. And there was a group that said, what if you could print beautiful pages slowly, one at a time, in cheap printers, and management snorted. So they had to leave California and went to Corvallis, Oregon to hide. And so in Corvallis, they created the division that invented inkjet, and that's the economic engine that powered HP. And the observation is inkjet printers produce as much as the volume printers, but every page is different. You wouldn't want printing in the home where you had to produce 1,000 copies of something. You use it because every page is different. And so the point of this industrial revolution is it doesn't scale with an assembly line. It scales by making everything different all the time, doing on-site, on-demand, local production, where data becomes things and things become data. So it's a fundamentally new business model for making things. Or another way to view what's emerging is these are some of the great national labs of Oak Ridge and LBL and Argonne. They're multi-billion dollar facilities, and they really struggle with their mission to have an impact in their local communities. This is President Obama visiting one of these fab labs at a community college in Ohio, at Lorain County, where it's just flourishing. If you think about the goals of a national lab, of developing advanced technology and conveying it and deploying it, once the tools become accessible, just like the MIT story, it means instead of locking them away in these very expensive central facilities, you can make a kind of a networked national laboratory. And so that led to a very unusual bill. Bill Foster, Representative Foster, is a congressman in Illinois. He got Denny Hastert's seat. He has a very unusual background. And he saw this network growing and realized we just couldn't keep up with it. And so he created this bill. This will be him describing it.
I'm United States Congressman Bill Foster, and I'm one of the few members of the United States House of Representatives who was a scientist before entering politics. So I often tell people that I represent about 1/3 of the strategic reserve of physicists in Congress. But when I came into work each day in physics, my first stop often wasn't to my office computer or some meeting, but to the laboratory machine shop to check on the progress of some parts that I designed for an experiment or for part of an accelerator. So I believe I can safely say that I'm the only member of the United States Congress that knows how to program numerically controlled machine tools. I'm proud to announce that I recently introduced legislation in the United States House of Representatives which supports the goals and mission of the National Fab Lab Network as in the best interests of our people and the best interests of promoting the goals of greater science and technical education, greater access to research and production tools, and empowerment of individuals to understand and use technology to improve their lives. You can think of the NFLN as a new kind of national lab in the United States that's a cloud laboratory, a national network of connected local labs. I've been lucky to have the chance to visit Neil and see the progenitor of all Fab Labs myself, and to work with the people in my own congressional district in Illinois who are planning to create their own. And I'm proud to count myself among the many supporters of this concept. The creation of the National Fab Lab Network and the legislation to support this bold new project are just the beginning of what I hope will be a long and bright future for the network of existing labs and the many more to come.
So he wrote this very cleverly with no money and no agency. And the reason is it emerged from lots of interagency meetings with agencies all across D.C. who it turned out had money to do this but didn't know how to spend it effectively. And so the model loosely was the creation of CPB that led to NPR. CPB was chartered as in a public-private partnership that CPB itself doesn't do it, but it provides the scaffolding. So in the same sense, this legislation proposes creating a national Fab Lab network as a public-private partnership. This doesn't place it either in an agency or with money, but endorses it and then leverages it. So all the things you need to support a network of life cycles of ordering and installation and training and reporting and best practices and coordinating educational programs and building the kind of research projects can be done instead of one-off as we do it today, but linked in the network. And then these labs aren't, it's not like a McDonald's franchise. They're integrated, like the example I showed you in Lorain County, but at the same time, they're part of this national network, creating really, I think, a visionary new notion of our national infrastructure linking community labs. It's a wonderful story. So he put that, we had expected it to come for a vote 2 weeks ago. So we brought our mobile Fab Lab down to Congress. It was wonderful. We had to get approval from the architect and the Capitol Police to bring high-power lasers up to the Capitol building. But we parked it right in front. Members came out and made stuff. It was a wonderful visit, great outpouring from the community. But then Congress decided to end a week early to go yell at each other. So the hope is this will come up for a vote. And right now, Bill's assembling support from communities that have or want labs. If you're interested, I can provide contacts. But it's already beginning to work. Just the existence of the legislation is creating a channel that helps money flow through. Now agencies are saying, yeah, that's what we really want to be doing. We want to be part of this network empowering invention. So it's having a big impact already. If you're interested in the discussion, I can tell you much more. So with that, I'd like to thank you. I love EDUCAUSE. I use .edu every day. But now stepping back this high-speed tour, computing as cash and interconnect really looks like it's going to go away. Computing becomes a raw material. Manufacturing as sort of neglected old stuff goes away and merges with computing. And if you do both of those, which is where the technology is going, it means that separating hardware, software, computer science, and physical science go away. And information technology, in a very deep sense, in the sense of von Neumann and Shannon, information technology is, you know, this stuff, not just that stuff. And so in that world, I think EDUCAUSE is needed more than ever, but it means you need to breach the boundary between bits and atoms, because the bits and atoms don't believe there's a boundary. And it means we also need to breach the boundary of centralized temples of learning and realize if anybody can make anything anywhere and communicate with anybody else, it radically changes how you live, work, and play. The stories I showed you are roughly as grainy as the picture of Bell Labs when Unix was being invented. That's the moment we're living through. We're way over our head in keeping up with it. So I look forward to and invite your participation in that story. And with that, I'll thank you and take questions.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.